talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I usually.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
Good morning and welcome to We Are Movie Geeks, the podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Lynn Venhouse.
Lynn Venhouse is sitting in for Michelle this morning. Usually when we have a guest, we ask them, you know, what their favorite movie is and who their favorite actor is. But Lynn was on with us a couple months ago, so we know Lynn's favorite actor is Adam Sandler.
We know.
And her favorite movie
we know
is,
your story, sister.
And her favorite movie is Pretty Woman. Is that right? Or is it Grease 2?
No, it's a Robot Monster, or is it Glenn or Glenda?
There you go.
Somebody actually told James Corden the other night, because he was acting like he was an usher, and somebody told him that their favorite movie was We're the Millers.
Really? Well, it's better than Love the Coopers.
All right.
So Michelle's not here today, but we have to do this whole top 10 list without her. She's really good at this. I'm not so good at this. So I'm going to give it my best shot. Okay. Today is November 24th, so over the weekend, number one made $100 million. $101 million was The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2, which Jim and I haven't seen, but Lynn has. It's the last installment, is that right?
Yes. Hallelujah!
So does Katniss get killed?
No. And that's not a spoiler. Well, maybe it is a spoiler, but if you've read the books, you know.
Yeah.
And I think this franchise is a big hit with the people that have read the books.
Yeah.
But if you haven't, the third book, Mockingjay, was known as the weakest one of the three. And they split it into two movies, just like Twilight did and Harry Potter did.
Yeah.
And it was not necessary. It's so bloated because of switching it.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people were just like ready to see it end.
But they do kill off the little sister, right? Did you interview her? I interviewed her, that little actress that played the little sister. I can't even think of her name. No.
Yeah, this
Willow
is
Fields?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Downtown somewhere.
Yeah, I'm just reading the notes Michelle provided said that this one was 17% down from the previous film. So that's somewhat surprising.
And she also wrote ends on a relatively downbeat note. I guess that's the whole sister dying thing. Not that we're not to spoil anything.
Well, it's very dark. It's very dark. Plus, it's gray and beige.
Well, that was $101 million. Number two was Spectre, 007, but it only made $14.6 million. So,
well, it's not.
So Hunger Games dominated. Peanuts movie, which I still haven't seen, but I'm going to see this weekend, made $12.8 million. The Night Before, Jim saw that. You reviewed it last week. That was number four at $10.1 million.
Yeah, yeah.
Secret in Their Eyes, which Lynn and I saw, was number five with $6.6 million.
I would have thought it would have been switched. I would have thought that that Secret would have done better than Night Before because it's so star-heavy, but it didn't. So.
It's very dark again.
It is. Number six, Love the Coopers, which Jim and I didn't love at all, but I know Lynn really liked Love the Coopers. Is that right, Lynn?
No. I'm with you guys.
Okay.
I said I liked some of them, but I didn't love them all.
I didn't love any of them. I hated them all.
Yes.
We should call it Hate the Coopers.
can't stand the Coopers.
But it's still, I guess it's number six. Is this the third week or just the second?
Well, because people love a holiday movie.
They're hard up.
They see the preview on TV and it looks all, you know, warm and fuzzy, and they don't realize that the guy who wrote it has all of his ideas that he ever had in his life in it.
Yeah. Which weren't very many. Okay. The Martian was number seven. That's been around for months and months. That's a great movie. Spotlight was number eight with 3.6. The 33, 2.2 million. I haven't seen that either. Bridge of Spies, 1.9 million. Goosebumps.
Strong.
Was number 11, 1.8 million. And Brooklyn, which I did see over the weekend.
Yeah,
that was a good movie.
That's pretty strong.
I really enjoyed that. That's going to be on my top 10, I think.
Yeah, possibly. I got a screener in the mail, but I was determined to see it on the big screen, so I went to the front.
Oh, it's beautifully filmed.
Saw it there. Yeah.
Oh, you did see it at the front.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So I don't know if you were going to wait till the high point got it. But
Saoirse Ronan. She's on my short list.
You know, the Frontenac is like the easiest movie theater to sneak into in the St. Louis area, by the way.
No. now, Tom. That's wrong.
You would never do that, would you?
Speaking of movie theaters, I was telling Lynn this last night. But I drove over to the screening last night. I had to pass by the new Walmart on Watson Road, and we had a discussion last time I saw you. I think about what was going up next to it. I was insistent it was a Lowe's.
Yeah.
They have the Kenrick movie theater sign up there, so it is
the Kenrick is brought back to life. Huh? Is it in the same location as the old Kenrick?
Pretty much the same location.
The same building?
Well, no, they demolished the old building. So it's brand new, brand spanking new. I'm assuming that everything will be stadium seating. I'm stunned by it. I'll be within walking distance again of a big movie theater. That's cool.
Well, I remember when I first started reviewing movies again for the News Democrat in 95, I would go there for screenings. That's where they had a lot of their pre-release screenings.
So hopefully they'll have an official announcement about an opening date or a proposed opening
date. It's a Werenberg, I assume.
It is going to be a Werenberg, yes. I'm just thrilled. That's my early Christmas present.
Yeah. You know, they opened a new theater a couple weeks ago on Page. In the city, like way up in north, like Wellston or something.
I saw that.
And it's got a weird name. It's called like the something. It's like a number in the name or something.
Yeah, but it's not one of the major chains.
No, it's not a major chain.
So that's interesting.
All right. Well, we're going to start reviewing movies here because there's a ton of movies to review. It's Thanksgiving week, so a bunch of movies start tomorrow. And we have seen them all, so we are on the ball. But the first thing we're going to do, let's call my wife. I've got my wife, Kelly, on the phone. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Tom.
I'm here with Jim and Lynn.
Hello.
Hi, Kelly.
Hi, guys.
You probably don't know Lynn, but you'd like her. So my wife, Kelly, is the only person in St. Louis that has seen the most anticipated movie for all of us movie geeks, and that is Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight.
Got room for one more?
I ain't too anxious to be handing out rides.
Real trusting fella, huh?
Not so much.
Ain't no way I'm spending a couple of nights under a roof with somebody I don't know who they are. So who are you?
You saw that last... Tell us... How come you got to see Hateful Eight so far in advance?
Oh, I feel super, super lucky. A very good friend of mine who I went to college with lives in New York, and he's a member of the Directors Guild, so was invited to this special screening in New York City in a regular plain old movie theater, although it was outfitted with the 70-millimeter projector, which was awesome, and Quentin Tarantino was in attendance and introduced the film and then stayed afterwards for a discussion with another director, Taylor Hackford, who is the former head of the Directors Guild, not currently, but a former member, and actually was instrumental in inviting Quentin Tarantino to join that group, which he didn't for many years, but did recently.
And what did we're jealous over here. When Quentin introduced the movie, what did he say about the film that you can share?
Well, he was super enthusiastic. He said, "Hey, everybody, thanks for coming," kind of like a big kid. And he said, "I'm so glad you're here. This was shot in 70 millimeter. Clearly, that was really important to him." And he waved his hand. He goes, "For those of you in the back half of the theater, you're going to see a beautiful film with great framing and really artful shots." He goes, "But for those of you in this front 15 rows, it's going to feel like you're inside the movie in Minnie's haberdashery." And he just loved that. He said, "So I hope you enjoy it." That was kind of his opening remarks.
We can't really have you review the movie because there's going to be an embargo on reviews.
Sure.
But give us a hint. It's about these eight characters and played by all these great actors. If you thought one of them was going to get an Oscar nom, who do you think did the best job of these eight actors?
Oh, my gosh. Wow. That's really... Samuel Jackson always delivers, especially in Tarantino's films. And as Tarantino himself said afterward, the first time he ever filmed Sam Jackson way back in Pulp Fiction, he said for the first time in his entire career of writing dialogue, he felt like the words that he'd written sang. You know, so he's obviously, everyone knows he's had this long partnership with Sam Jackson, but it was really neat for Quentin Tarantino to describe that journey and what makes Sam Jackson so special to Quentin Tarantino in his writing. So Sam Jackson was his usual brilliant self. Bruce Dern had a small role, but it was powerful. I enjoyed him a lot. This new guy, is it Goggins?
Walter Goggins, yeah.
I thought his performance was really powerful because it was quiet and kind of behind the scenes, and it just grew in importance as the movie progressed, and he became more intense and more important to the story, and he really delivered. I thought he was spectacular.
He's a New York stage actor.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Well, he looks great on film. He looked great on film.
He was in Django.
Yeah, he started to do more movies. He was in American Ultra, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he was great. Whether they'd be nominated for Oscars, those are the three that kind of caught my eye.
What about Jennifer Jason Leigh? How is she?
She's good. You know, she's a scary little character. You know, she's the outlaw. Not a very big speaking role. In some ways, even though she's present throughout the film, in some ways, her role is smaller than you might think.
I see. And what did Taylor Hackford have to say about the film and his discussion with Quentin afterwards?
Well, Taylor Hackford clearly loves Quentin Tarantino and admires his work greatly. So he really asked him about working with Sam Jackson, which I kind of already talked a little bit about. He talked to him about the soundtrack. I'm working with Morricone, mm-hmm. and how that journey was, and that was a pretty interesting thing to hear. And I guess you guys probably know this. It was news to me that this is really the first time Tarantino has had someone score his films. He's always mm-hmm. just pieced together and used Morricone's right. former scores. But how fabulous that was, and that experience. Taylor Hackford asked a lot of the details of the film, the characters' teeth, the lighting, the staging. You know, this film very much is in some ways very theatrical. It's interesting you would say that the one actor has a theater background because the whole second half of the film takes place in one location, so it has a very theatrical feel to it. Mm-hmm. We actually had an intermission, which was kind of cool. And it was over 3 hours. We started at 7:30 and ended at 11:30 with maybe a 20-minute intermission.
So that's pretty exciting. And we're all jealous over here at We Are Movie Geeks.
I can't believe how lucky I was because I didn't know that. I mean, I got a call that morning saying, hey, I've changed our plans. How does this sound? And, of course, I was like, oh, my gosh. And what I would tell you, the other thing I would add that just speaks volumes about the kind of person Quentin Tarantino is, I went down afterward to get his autograph, but he was already gone. But you know where he had moved to the exit of the theater, and he was there to say goodbye and shake hands to everybody that came to the movie.
Wow.
And that, what a treat. How awesome of him to be that available and that open and that friendly. It was really great.
All right. Well, cool, baby. Well, thanks for calling in. And
you movie lover. You movie
yeah, and tonight, and tonight we're going to go see Me and You, The Big Short.
Yes, we are.
All right, good. All right. Thanks again.
Guys.
Talk
Bye.
To you tonight. Bye-bye.
Bye, Callie.
Bye.
Okay, enough about The Hateful Eight. We need to review a whole bunch of movies that opened Friday and a bunch of movies open tomorrow, which will be the day before Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the number one movie over this past weekend, Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2, which Jim and I avoided. I mean, missed. Lynn got to see it.
I could have seen it, but mm-hmm. I was like, eh.
Our lives were never ours. They belong to Snow, and our deaths do too. But if you kill him, Katniss, if you end all of this, all those deaths, they mean something.
Yes. Lynn, what'd you think of
Well,
Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2.
True confession, I got to page 56 of the book, the first book, and I just said, I'm done with this. But I've had to see the four movies because of what I do. So I'm not the biggest fan of the young adult fiction of the brand new world being saved by young teens in a dystopian future, so I want to get that right up. But the people who did read the books and like them, they think this is a faithful adaptation and it's a satisfying conclusion. The only thing going for me in these movies is the cast. I think the cast is appealing because Jennifer Lawrence is mesmerizing on screen. And then Donald Sutherland plays such a despicable dictator,
yeah.
You know, and it's fun to see him in it. And then you know, Woody Harrelson and Elizabeth Banks, and then they got the cute guys, you know, the Liam Hemsworth and
what about
is it Gail or Peta?
Philip Seymour Hoffman is.
Unfortunately, you know, he died before he could finish it.
Okay, so what do they do?
So they don't have him electronically.
So they just wrote out his character.
They wrote out. So he's in it just for a brief time, but then like. He sends letters with messages, that kind of thing. So
how cheesy.
They rewrote his scenes, but it's just sad seeing him, I think. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that because they broke the last novel into two movies, it's just so dour and bloated, and they have all these long pauses and meaningful glances, and it's very dark. And it's just all about the revolution and her saving, you know, the future of Pan Am. So if you care about that, you're going to care. I didn't really care.
But is it sad when the little sister dies?
It's so funny. I just read Mindy Kaling's new book, and she mentions Hunger Games. It's like, what's with that worthless younger sister? She's just useless. It's so funny.
It is sad. But there's a lot of really brutal action in it. Yeah.
Well, it looks like there's a lot, some CG CGI beasties in it, kind of all, you know, coming after the characters.
Yeah. It's kind of like The Descent with those creatures under, you know, in the caves. All of a sudden they have this big battle with these really grotesque creatures. So some of it's kind of scary and dark. But, you know, if you like that, then you're going to like it. If you don't, like you guys stayed away.
Well, I saw the first two, and I was like, I just don't care. You know? And I'm not a fan of the other sort of.
Did you review it? No, Lynn reviews for the Belleville News Democrat. Did you review it for your newspaper?
Yes,
it did. How many stars did you give it?
I gave it two.
Two, but you're on the 4-star system, right?
Yeah, four.
That would have been 2.5 on the We Are Movie Geek system.
Yeah, so that's basically saying it's mediocre.
Yeah,
I guess
you're right up the middle. But no bad review is going to keep audiences away from that. My spoiling that the little sister gets killed is going to keep audiences away from.
But critic proof, I think.
Well, it is surprising that it's down from the last installment. So maybe some people are getting tired of it. Maybe the people that aren't devout followers of the books don't really care about it.
Maybe they're waiting. They think the crowds are going to be too big, and they're waiting to see it next week.
Well,
or something.
A good friend of mine, she is a rabid fan, but she says the last book that Katniss was whiny. And she, you know, so I mean, even some of the fans.
Yeah.
But that third movie was such a snooze. I think that has affected the box office.
Well, that was another reason I didn't see this one. I didn't see the last one.
I didn't see the last one either. Saw the first two.
Had no interest
in seeing.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, remember the second one, we had to sit there and watch the Twitter feeds from 13-year-olds Galaxy.
I wasn't at that one, luckily.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, that was a special thing they had. They had like a video stream from the premiere or something, and it's delayed it like an hour or something. Or is that what I heard? That's rough.
All right, so Lynn doesn't really recommend The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2, but she does recommend Good Dinosaur.
That creature protected you.
What is his name?
I don't know.
I name him, I keep him. Killer.
Stinky.
Violet.
Smite.
Lunatic.
Spot. Spot. Come here, Spot, come here.
Well, ain't you just the cutest thing?
Did you like Good Dinosaur?
Yes,
Land?
I did.
Okay, you guys saw that last night.
Yeah, we did.
It opens tomorrow. Uh-huh. And that's the newest from Pixar. Is that unusual for them to do two movies in 1 year?
That is very unusual. I don't think they had a release last year, so maybe this is kind of making up for that. It's kind of a little bonus treat for the end of the year. It's not as strong as Inside Out. That's why led in the summertime. But I would say if Inside Out is a home run, this is a solid double.
Yeah, it's a really good family film for people to take their whole family at this time of year. It's all about family's everything, finding your way home. It's a very familiar theme, you know, just like Wizard of Oz and those Far From Home movies, you know,
or Finding Nemo. There's a lot of that in there. There's even a little touch of the Jungle Book at the very end of it there.
But is it as good as The Croods?
I enjoyed it a lot more than The Croods. There were some people at the screen last night that said The Croods was better, but The Croods seemed a little more Flintstone-like than this. Croods. What's really interesting to me is, well, we're talking about how this is for kids, but it doesn't sugarcoat a lot of stuff, of course, like Lion King, which it owes a lot to also. There is a parental death, and there are cute, cuddly creatures that get eaten. And right in front of you, just kind of interesting. But
it's darker than usual. You know, I think it's going to suffer because it comes after Inside Out, which is so profound and magical. And this is just your straight, lovable Disney adventure. But the best thing about it, I think, besides Sam Elliott being the
one
voice. Don't
you spoiled it, stinker!
Well, that's the best thing in the whole movie. But the realism of the vistas and the panoramas.
Oh,
and
it's just gorgeous.
It's just unbelievably
beautiful.
Was that
beautiful. In 3D last night?
Yeah, we saw it in 3D. I don't think the 3D is necessary, but it's a nice little added touch. What interests me, being having an art background, was the character design, because the main Brontosaurus family has sort of a cartoony look to them, more so than a lot of dinosaurs and other CG type of films, even some 2D type films. But one thing I love about it, we did spoil something about one of the voice actors, but Pixar doesn't go for the easily recognized celebrity type voices. There are some animated films where they're just touting all the different celebs that are in it, and here it's people that are that really fit into the characters a lot more.
I hear Sam Elliott does a voice.
Well, that may be my favorite character from the movie. There's a sequence. It's basically this brontosaurus named Arlo, and he sort of befriends a little boy, a little mute cave boy named Spot. And it's them encountering these odd creatures. There's an animal collecting triceratops. It's very funny. There's a trio, a foursome of pterodactyls that are obsessed with the weather, who have an interesting character arc. I won't spoil more than that. And there's the T-Rex trio, who are basically herding these, they call them longhorns, but they're bison. And it turns into a Western for about 20 minutes, and it's really amusing. And there's some wrestlers that I guess they're supposed to be raptors, and they're very good, too. And I thought there was enough to recommend it in it. It's like I say, it's not Inside Out, but then again, it's not Bug's Life or Cars. It's better than those films, I think. So. Okay.
So Jim and Lynn both like The Good Dinosaur, though it's not as good as Inside Out, and it's in 3D though.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly enjoyed it more than Home earlier this year and the Minions movie. So you know,
a movie that Jim and I saw last week that's not in 3D is By the Sea.
Oh, maybe the 3D had helped somehow.
That stars Brad Pitt and the newly christened Angelina Jolie Pitt, and she wrote and directed this odd film about a couple vacationing in France, although it was filmed in Malta, and he's a sort of a writer with writer's block who's trying to get away and work on this novel, and she's depressed, and they go to this this villa, this hotel on this seaside, and they argue, and she walks along the shore, and she smokes, and he drinks, and he types, but he gets frustrated, and he hangs out with the bartender, and she reads magazines, and it's an odd film. I actually sort of enjoyed it, though, in spite of its tedium. I had pretty low expectations. I kept reading what a train wreck this movie was, but I kind of dug it. I thought Angelina Jolie as a director was kind of going for this sort of arty European-style rhythm of a lot of movies from the 60s and 70s, and I think she succeeded, at least at what she was going for. I think she succeeded quite well, and she's really, really good in this film, as is Brad Pitt. They stay in this hotel, and then there's this other couple played by Melanie Laurent and an actor whose name I don't know, and they're on their honeymoon next door. So Angelina conveniently finds this hole in the wall of their room, which peaks right at bed level to the room where this honeymooning couple who are trying to get pregnant. So all they do is have intercourse. So Angelina and her husband they sit on the floor with their little picnic and they take turns looking through the hole at this couple. And I never quite understood why. It's a pretty big hole. I never understood why this other couple didn't notice this big hole in the wall with Angelina Jolie's big old eyeball sticking through it all day long.
Maybe they're expecting Jerry the Mouse to pop through there.
Yeah, I guess. But I went to this movie with low expectations, and I kind of ended up liking it in spite of myself. Jim, you liked it less than me.
Oh, I had low expectations, and it went past them down. Oh, my gosh. It's like you're deciding to vacation in off-season someplace, and the only other cabin or room there is occupied by another couple, and the couple is the most vapid, depressing, self-involved couple, and you're just stuck with them for 2 hours, and it feels like you're stuck with them for the entire 2 weeks when you're watching this movie. It just goes on and on. I just read yesterday that Universal agreed to this film because they were hoping that Angelina would star in Wanted 2 or a remake of The Bride of Frankenstein, so they basically took about a $50 million bath on this thing.
That was $10 million.
Oh, but with the promotion and all that.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, so they're never going to make it back, and it kind of reminded me of what Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor were doing in the 60s. Then they would want to, occasionally the stuff they would do would be classics like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or Taming the Shrew, but other times you'd get stuff like The Sandpiper or Dr. Faustus, and this is like one of those. They're just...
Those movies were very popular in the 60s because of the star power of Liz and Dick, and I think Brad and Angelina had that similar sort of star power. You go see this movie... I'll grant you it's a bit tedious, but you can just sit there and watch these two actors. And Angelina, you got to hand it to her. She made some bold choices, and she does some topless scenes, which she used to do topless scenes earlier in her career, and then she won an Oscar and got kind of big, and she does some topless scenes in this movie. And she, I think 2 years ago, she had a double mastectomy. So you've got to sort of admire her doing some of these things in this film.
But if it was in service of a better script, I mean, this couple is just so... I would give the movie... someone asked me how many stars I give it. I give it a star for Melanie Laurent. She is a bright ray of sunshine in this film. And otherwise, it's just these two really, down and depressing people. And, Brad spends most of his time when he's not, screaming at Angelina in it, he's going down to this local pub. And I forget the actor's name. He's a character actor from France. He's very good in it. But he just sits there and watches everybody and drinks and smokes. And in one time, you get to see him being belligerent and, really abusive to the owner. And it's just so unpleasant. It's a weird makeup choice for Angelina. She's got such beautiful eyes, and it looks like they overdid the smoky makeup. So it's almost getting to raccoon area. And she's wearing a hairstyle. It's supposed to be 1970-71 because you see you're reading a magazine with Pat Nixon on the cover. But the hairstyles just aren't very, very flattering to her. I think they could have made some more interesting choices. When she puts her hair up, she kind of reminded me of Monica Vitti, I guess, from the 60s films.
Modesty Blaze.
Yeah, but it's just so long and tedious.
I disagree. I think it's getting a bad rap because she's trying to recreate this sort of French style of film. And I think if some French director had come out, Claude Chabrol or something, had come out with this exact same movie, people would fall all over themselves praising it.
Oh, but I think it's deserving of the bad rap it's getting. It's just so self-indulgent.
Now, didn't she write it?
But she wrote it,
Is it adapted from a novel?
No.
It's just completely original.
She came up with this.
It's just, like I say, I don't know. What they were putting it together. And you say they've got Universal behind it, but they were hoping for a little reward later on, and that's not happening, I guess, for it.
All right. So I recommend By the Sea, and Jim does not. Something a bit more mainstream, which you guys saw and I still haven't seen, is Creed.
You're not built for this. These boys come in here. They got to fight for life. People die in the ring. Your daddy died in the ring.
I don't know him. Ain't got nothing to do with me.
I heard about a third fight between you and Apollo. Behind closed doors. Is that true?
How do you know all this?
I'm a son.
Did you see Creed, man?
Yes,
okay.
I loved it.
All right, what's so great about Creed?
It's the best Rocky installment, even though it's not typically a Rocky 7, it's still the best Rocky movie since the original.
Wait a minute, better than Rocky 4?
I will break Dolph. You.
Yes, and that's the lesson. I did not see 5 or Rocky Balboa, but I will say...
Wait a minute, was there a 5?
Yes.
Yes, there was. Yes, with there Tommy was. Morrison was the protagonist.
Oh, is that the one where Sage Stallone...
I believe so, yeah.
...played his son?
Yeah,
and,
yeah. And then Sage Stallone died a couple years ago.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a really great relationship. But I think the difference in this movie is the director, Ryan Coogler. He directed Fruitvale Station, his first movie, and it starred Michael B. Jordan, who plays Adonis Johnson, which is Apollo Creed's son in this. He has infused this with so much energy, but also it's very sentimental in terms of the original Rocky story.
Mm. Is he better than he was in Fantastic Four?
Yes. And he's quite chiseled. Quite chiseled. He really worked out. But the big surprise, I think, is Stallone, how excellent he is in this. And you know, he took the iconic Rocky part that we all know and love, or maybe not we all, but I particularly am a big fan of the original Rocky, and I always tear up every time Rocky goes up the steps of the art museum. So this is a tailor-made movie for people like me who have great fondness for early Stallone. And he is, but because his son died, I think there's a vulnerability there, and his eyes but it's just like a life lived, and he's got real.
Oh yeah, he's really strong in it. Yeah,
and they make this relationship because Adonis was bounced around in foster homes because his dad died in the ring, but he doesn't even know he's his dad till Creed's wife, Marianne, who's played by Felicia Rashad, and she's actually very good in it. Mm-hmm. She has a few scenes. And she comes to the juvenile detention center and takes him home, and he becomes a successful financial advisor. But he fights on the side at these black market fights in Tijuana, and he's 15-0 in this black market in Tijuana. And he realizes that he has to go to Philadelphia and train with Rocky if he's ever going to make himself into somebody. So that's where we are. That's where the meat of the story is. There's such a great relationship between those two. It really, that's when the movie really kicks off. But also Ryan Coogler wrote it. And so it's just a really good screenplay and really good direction. But I haven't seen an audience applaud through a movie in a long time.
Well, I think that's because of the film's strengths. I will be a little bit of the detractor here, the other side. I would say the stuff in the ring soars. Yes. That's when the movie comes alive. It's got some of the best. But it puts Southpaw earlier this year to shame in the way that they shoot the boxing scenes. There's I don't know if it's the Tijuana match or maybe the first real boxing match, but you feel like you're right over the shoulder of these guys in the ring, and it's you're right feeling every punch. It's almost, and it soars when it's in the ring. Anytime that Stallone is on screen as Rocky, it works. There's a very funny scene in which Rocky tries to comprehend the meaning of the internet and the cloud, and that's a very funny sequence. My problem with it is that when it's out of the ring and Rocky's not in it, it just kind of mopes around. There's a romance that they try to have going in it between Donis's neighbor in his rundown Philly apartment, and it's played by Tessa Thompson, and she's an aspiring songwriter and singer, and it's not enough that she's trying to get her stuff out there. They've settled her with a degenerative hearing loss. So she's like, yeah, I wear these hearing aids because I'm going to lose my hearing in a couple of years. I'm going to make the most of it. And I was like, you got to throw that at the character too. Yeah. And it just seems a little too much.
So Felicia Rashad, wasn't she on the Cosby Show?
Yeah.
Does Bill Cosby make a cameo in this?
No. But Tessa Thompson made a really strong debut in a movie called Dear White People, and she's pretty feisty for a female character, so it's good. But the music, everything you love about the early Rocky, the whole underdog thing. But you're right about the fight sequences; they are exhilarating. And the first one was done with one long take.
Oh, that's right, the Tijuana one. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Well, I got to see that. That sounds really good. So, Lynn and Jim both recommend Creed. Another movie that opens this Wednesday is Victor Frankenstein.
Igor, you and I shall be at the very heart of a scientific enterprise that will change the world. We shall create a life out of death. It's alive.
Do you realize how significant this is?
Oh, I have an inkling.
Which Jim saw last night. Jim, how is this movie, Victor Frankenstein?
Actually, I got to see it in the afternoon yesterday, so okay. Maybe it would have been creepier in the night. I don't know. But this is sort of a reimagining. It's written by Max Landis.
Who did earlier this year, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Yes.
Didn't he?
No, he did American Ultra.
Oh, he did American Ultra. Okay, yeah, I was confused.
And prior to that, it was Chronicle. And
I knew he did some bad movie this year.
But they are setting this in the late 1800s. It starts off in London at a circus, and the focus is not really Victor Frankenstein, but Igor. But when we first meet Igor, played by Daniel Radcliffe, he doesn't have a name. He's just an anonymous hunchback that is a clown in this circus in London, kind of sleazy circus as usual,
Igor.
Kind of a scary one.
So we've gone from Dwight Frye to Bela Lugosi to Daniel Radcliffe.
Well, he had John Cusack in that animated thing a little while ago. That was called Igor, the animated film. But basically, he's rescued out of the circus by Victor Frankenstein, played by James McAvoy, perhaps best known now as Professor Xavier, the young Professor Xavier from the X-Men franchise. And he takes him in because Radcliffe's character is fascinated by anatomy and all that, or particularly the anatomy of the trapeze performer Lorelei in the film. So Victor Frankenstein is in London studying, and of course he's got some weird stuff going on at his place with his experiments. And because his roommate has been gone off in an opium den somewhere, he tells Daniel Radcliffe, "You could be, you know, pretend you're my roommate Igor." So that's how he gets his name. Of course, Victor is stealing animal parts from different places. That's why he was at the circus. And so they put together this creature that you might see in the trailers, this weird sort of chimp monkey hybrid type of thing. Of course, they want to bring it to life and things go wrong, but a rich sort of snooty upper, you know, aristocrat decides to bankroll them because Victor's father, in a great cameo by Charles Dance, sort of cuts him off. And he says, "You're nothing like your brother Henry." And so that's kind of a nice tie into the Universal film.
What does he say? What's the Vector Victor?
No. But we do hear, you know, when they're doing their experiment, he tells Igor to up the power, and he says, "Yes, master." So we get that. And that's part of the problem with the film. They want to do some sort of campy references to the original Universal films or even to the Hammer films of the 60s. But, you know, some of it is just so over the top, and it seems like a lot of frantic action sequences, a lot of slow motion stuff. McAvoy's performance, he's so over the top as Victor that he's practically spewing his lines. I was telling I told you, Tom, earlier, I was glad it wasn't in 3D because he's a juicy talker, that James McAvoy. And, you know, he's spewing pretty much. And I also mentioned, like they show a little bit of him in the trailer, but like the Universal horror films of the 40s, particularly Glenn Strange when he was playing the creature, he doesn't do anything until the last 5 or 6 minutes of the movie. Mm-hmm. And of course they do have the big experiment. They luckily go to the Alps, and because, you know, Victor Frankenstein can't be doing his stuff in downtown London. It just doesn't work. You do see a creature, you know, running around. When they're planning out the building of the creature, they say, "Well, he's going to have two hearts and two sets of lungs and a flat head." And Igor says, why a flat head? He says, "Because I like it," he says. And so you have this big, tall guy who's kind of reminiscent of, we mentioned Dave Prowse in Horror Frankenstein. I mentioned the creature from Jesse James Meets Frankenstein's Daughter. But I mentioned, Tom, that in profile, he kind of looks like Dick Tracy. His face does. It's kind of weird. So he's about 7 feet tall.
Okay.
But I just can't recommend the film. Mm. It's mediocre, maybe at the most 2.5, maybe 3 stars. Okay. But it looks nice. The art direction's good. But, you know, it's not going to make me forget Peter Cushing or, you know, Colin Clive. That's for certain.
Okay. What a weird time of year to open it, though, isn't it?
Yeah, that would have been, you know, like last month or about 6 weeks ago, maybe.
Yeah, I think the next movie we're going to review is Secret in Their Eyes, which I think also is kind of a weird time to review this, or to release, rather, this sort of serious murder drama right in the middle of Thanksgiving. I gave Secrets in Their Eyes 4 out of 5 stars. Secrets in Their Eyes stars Julia Roberts and Chiwetel Ejiofor. and Nicole Kidman.
LAPD just found an unidentified female body in a garage dumpster.
What are we doing here, guys?
Body appears to have been bleached inside and out.
Ray, what is it?
It's Carol. It's your daughter.
What?
It's mom.
Help!
It's I wouldn't even call it a murder mystery because the killer is identified pretty early on. But it's really about memory, and it jumps back and forth in time, and it's about revenge, and it's about a lot of big issues. I liked it quite a bit. I sort of had low expectations going into it. I think it's kind of a movie where you either have high expectations because it's got these A-list Oscar-winning stars, although I think Love the Coopers has sort of disproven that putting Oscar winners in a movie is going to make it good. Or you had low expectations because the trailer looks sort of lame. But I found this pretty gripping and intelligent and a fun movie to sort of follow along with. I thought Julia Roberts especially was really quite good. She's really sort of deglammed herself in this film. And the trailer sort of lets you know that her daughter dies in the opening. And so she's really this wounded, damaged character. And by the end of the film, she's quite the mess. Less successful, I think, was Nicole Kidman. I think her role was sort of underwritten. I really didn't know exactly what purpose she was supposed to be playing. It's a remake of an Argentinian film from 2009 of the same title that won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film that year. I think it was an upset winner. In that, there's this romance between Chiwetel Ejiofor and Nicole Kidman that doesn't really go anywhere. It's sort of half-baked. That romance in the Argentinian film was really at the center of the film. So they felt like they had to throw it in for some reason. They probably would have been better off leaving it out. The film is heavily plotted enough. It really didn't need this romance. But I kind of dug a Secret in Their Eyes. Lynn, however, didn't like it nearly as much as I did. What were your problems with Secret in Their Eyes, Lynn?
Well, you mentioned one of them, Nicole Kidman. Whatever work she has had done, or Botox, or, you know, any plastic surgery, she is expressionless on her face now in movies, yeah. I think. And she and Chiwetel have zero chemistry. There's no sexual tension for this. They keep looking at each other with these long glances, and I don't get it. So that sunk it for me. Yeah. But I do think that gray line between justice and vengeance is a very fascinating one. Another switch from the original, which I didn't see, but I read about the original. The baseball references to me don't work because this kid is an Eastern European Muslim. Why would he have extensive knowledge of the Los Angeles Dodgers and be so passionate about the Los Angeles Dodgers? Where I heard the original, they said it in a soccer soccer stadium.
El Monumental Soccer Stadium in Argentina.
And that probably, you know, didn't work. But I agree with you on Julia Roberts. She's so raw and real in the beginning scene. She has, you know, over the years, because she played the daughter in August Osage County, she has really developed a harder edge to her instead of the Pretty Woman.
Mm-hmm. Your favorite movie, Pretty Woman.
Yeah. But it's not that you're more of an Eat, Pray, Love gal.
Yeah. And it's also interesting because it takes place in two different time periods. It keeps jumping back and forth, and I think it does that pretty effectively. And in physically, though, you've got Chiwetel Ejiofor. He puts this gray in his hair to differentiate between the two periods. And Julia Roberts, you know, is looks a lot better in 2002, and then she's really sort of haggard in the 2015 scenes. But Nicole Kidman makes no effort to differentiate between the 13-year period. She looks exactly the same.
Her hairstyle.
Is her hair... Yeah, but her face.
Well, wasn't Julia's role in the original Argentina a man, right?
Yes, it was.
That's what I thought. Yeah, that's what I read somewhere,
Well, I thought too many of the plot points were just a convenience. Like when they're on the elevator and the door opens and it's the suspect.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, really?
I thought that was a chilling scene. I thought that was a great scene. And, you know, it could happen. All right, so Lynn didn't like it. I did like it. I gave it a 4 out of 5. How many stars did you give it for the Belleville News Democrat?
Two out of four.
So you were... 2, I was 4. All right. I don't think it's going to do a whole lot of business. It came
number five,
but it's really going to drop off with all these more blockbustery mainstream movies opening tomorrow.
Yeah,
so see it while you can. I really liked Secret in Their Eyes. All right. Now we're going to talk about The Night Before, which is a comedy that Jim is the only one in the room that has seen.
I have a present for you. We're going to the best Christmas party in New York City.
So that gives us several hours to hit as many traditions as possible.
To the end of an era.
I think the cocaine and the mushrooms are reacting.
poorly?
You look insane. Only your right eye is working.
Do I look weird now?
Yes, you look weird. Still weird. Weirder.
It's Seth Rogen.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I'll tell you who's in it via the plot here. Basically, it's about three buddies. And when we first meet them, it's about a dozen years ago. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, his parents are killed, I guess, on the eve of Christmas, just a few days before.
How cheery. Crime.
Yeah, really. What a way to start a comedy. He's having a rough time, and his two best buddies from high school, who are Seth Rogen and Anthony Mackie, decide that they're going to make it a tradition that they're going to be with their buddy and cheer him up on Christmas Eve every night. And so when we get to the current year, 2015, it is going to be the last one because Rogan's character is about to become a father, and Anthony Mackie is doing very well in football, so he can't really party with him like he used to because he's a celebrity and they're getting paparazzi following him and all that. It turns out that the reason Anthony Mackie is doing so well, they show him doing some little enhancements to him himself in the bathroom before big games and such. So we've got that subplot. We've got the subplot of him, not getting along with his teammates. Actually, the golden boy on the team wants Mackie to fetch him some pharmaceuticals for celebrating on Christmas Eve. Oh, when they first start partying, they get wind of a special secret party that goes on at Christmas Eve called the Nutcracker Ball that you can only get into via these magical red tickets that you have to finagle to get, and they have to be issued to you, and you have to, get called by the people that are putting on the party about where the party is with a little advance warning. And so they're determined that one year they're going to get those tickets, and what do you know, this final year, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character scores the tickets. And so when the guys meet up, they're killing time until 10 o'clock when they're going to get the phone call as to where the party is. And so they're going on these sort of random adventures. I think I compared it a little bit to After Hours in that they meet all these kind of strange people. I don't want to give away too much because it seems much like This Is the End. It seems like it's just filled with comedy actors and comedians, stand-up comics that you would know. And I'm sitting there watching and I went, oh, there's so-and-so, there's so-and-so, that I knew the main three actors in it, but I didn't know the other actors in it. And it's very entertaining.
Oh, tease us. Who are one of these actors that pop up?
Well, I guess I can tell you, since he's in the trailer, is that Joseph Gordon-Levitt has an unrequited love for Lizzie Kaplan, who TV viewers may know her mostly for playing part of Masters and Johnson on Masters of Sex.
She's a Mean Girls.
Yeah, well, she was in Mean Girls, I guess. She was in The Interview last year.
Okay, that's right.
That almost didn't make theaters.
Yeah.
She was
tease us a little better. Tell us somebody who's in it who's not in the trailer. Come on.
Oh, okay. Well, they has been mentioned that Michael Shannon is in it.
Okay.
One of our favorite actors.
Yeah.
Yes, he's had a great year with 99 Homes, and he's about the best thing in Freeheld, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But he plays Mr. Green, their old high school pot dealer.
Actually, Ellen Page's flannel shirts are the best. But go on.
Yes. I thought Julianne Moore's fair hairstyle was the best thing. Freeheld. But he's this sort of magical pot dealer, and his scenes in it are just hysterical.
Okay.
And there's a lot of drug jokes as usual. Seth Rogen's wife, who is played by here's another one I give away, Jillian Bell. She is an emerging comedy star. She practically stole 22 Jump Street.
Oh, I know who she is.
Oh, yeah, the blonde. Yeah, yeah. and she's very funny playing Seth Rogen's very pregnant wife, and a sort of an extra little bonus for letting him go party with his friends on Christmas Eve. She gives him a little box filled with all manner of different drugs.
Hmm.
And
the trailer.
Yeah, Seth Rogen just, said, there's cocaine. People still do cocaine? Oh, yeah, I think so. And so he's imbibing in everything. And it's very funny watching Seth try to retain his composure while sort of hallucinating through a lot of it. And he's got this really intense look on his face. It's very funny.
So it's a funny movie.
Yeah, it's funny. It's got some lulls. Like a lot of comedies, it has that one-hour sort of drag part where it's just kind of losing steam, but it crops right back up and gets back on track. And any Christmas movie that references Die Hard is I'm on the side of it already. So, okay. Yeah, I give it 4 out of 5.
Okay, well, Jim thinks The Night Before is funny. I'm going to have to go see that. That looks great. There's a bunch of other movies opening soon. There's some other screenings we're going to. Tonight, you guys are seeing
Legend,
yeah, yes. Which I saw at the St. Louis International Film Festival and reviewed last week. I think it's one of the best films of the year, and I hope you guys like it as much as I do. I am seeing The Big Short.
You know what? I'm pissed off. American people are getting screwed by the big banks.
And I am getting madder and madder.
There's some shady stuff going down.
You kids.
The banks were having a big old party. A few outsiders saw it when no one else could.
I'm sure the world's banks have more incentives than greed.
You're wrong.
Which stars Brad Pitt and Steve Carell and Christian Bale. I don't know why
Ryan Gosling.
They couldn't get a cast for this film, I guess. Maybe they didn't have the budget.
Yeah, what's interesting is it's directed by Adam McKay, who's mostly known for comedies.
Will Ferrell comedies.
Yeah. So this is kind of a little change for him. It's kind of like Jay Roach directing Trumbo here a couple of weeks ago. So.
Mm-hmm. So I'll be back next week with a review of Big Short, and Jim will be back to share his feelings on Legend. Jim and I saw Madman over the weekend.
A madman.
His name is Mars. Madman Mars.
Madman Mars. He's real.
He's real.
That was part of the late night Grindhouse film.
My goodness.
And it was a slasher movie from 1982. And Andy, who runs that midnight show, was all excited about this newly struck 35mm print that they had used for the Blu-ray. And so the studio sent him the wrong print, apparently. It was a very faded pink print. But you notice it didn't have any scratches on it.
I was used to seeing the little green scratches.
Yeah, it was like a scratch-free print, but it was really pink. So it was like a print. It must have just sat around. It didn't look like it had been projected very often. And it didn't really ruin. I think sort of a scratchy red print sort of adds to the grindhouse ambience. I kind of enjoy when you have a scratchy print.
You feel like you're wanting to stick to the floor there.
Or you're at the drive-in or something.
Oh, yeah.
But unfortunately, Mad Men, I thought was a pretty mediocre slasher movie from that period. It didn't, the gore was sort of minimal. There was no nudity. What it was good for was unintentional laughs.
Oh yeah, it's a camp classic now, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's that one scene in the hot tub.
The most unerotic hot tub scene ever.
And it's got Galen Ross, who was in Dawn of the Dead, who changed her name for this movie. I don't blame her. And some goofy actor with this weird frozen smile on his face.
Yeah, he had a sneer even when he's supposed to be a nice guy. He alternates between a nice guy and a jerk.
Yeah.
But luckily, without giving much away, the movie's over 30 years old. He gets off first, and you're like, well, good. He's kind of annoying.
But they're in this hot tub, and they're sort of spinning around and talking this weird.
Then it shows the close up of him unbuckling his belt buckle, and it's like, oh my gosh. And it's kind of
one of those old fashioned belt buckles that people used to have in the 70s where it was like a rock band or something on the belt buckle.
And it's just a really unattractive navel. I hate to say it.
Yeah.
It's an Audi, I think, and it's just not.
All right. Well, it's still, it's always fun seeing an old slasher movie on the big screen, especially at the High Point.
Oh, we had fun with it that night.
And next month, he's doing
They Live.
They Live, yeah. John Carpenter's They Live.
Quite a bit of a cult building around that film.
Oh, yeah.
Roddy
definitely.
Piper.
Yeah, and Roddy Piper passed away recently. And so that should do that'll be a lot of fun.
What great line is from that?
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
They have it in the trailer.
Chewing gum and remember when Al Pacino stole that line in that lousy gangster movie?
Yeah,
it was the same line with Christopher Walken.
The stand-up guys or whatever that was.
Something like that. All right, well, we've got to wrap it up. We'll be back next week. I don't know what we're going to talk about next week. We're going to talk about The Danish Girl. We're going to talk about The Big Short. We can talk about, we'll find things to talk about. We always do, but for now, I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Lynn Venhouse.
Thanks for filling in for Michelle, Lynn. You did a great job.
Yes, thanks
Lynn.
For inviting me.
And check us out at We Are Movie Geeks, the podcast, next week.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, black leather, ta ta ta. Black leather, black leather.
Oh, naughty, Stike.
Hello, Don. Hi. Black leather, black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling. Black leather, rock.